I am Plata on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the great treats doing this is that from time to time you get to talk to real legends. But beyond that, you have the opportunity to talk to remarkable people you grew up with, people who entertained and enlightened you for many years. Brian Forst joins me now, better known as Frosty Forst, who for over 30 years ruled the morning airwaves as the host of CKNW's ratings leader, made many a morning a little more fun with his rapier wit, charm, and what Jack Wasserman described as his saber tongue. Nobody was funnier, nobody was as quick-witted. From 1973, when he succeeded Bob Hutton, to 2005, he was tops in this town, 32 years out of a career that spanned more than 50. We'll reflect on radio's past, present, and future. I'll get Mr. Forst to indulge me in reminiscing about some former colleagues, some legends in the lore of Vancouver radio. Since retiring nearly a decade ago, the infamously reclusive Brian Forst has done done very few interviews, chiefly a terrific radio history with Mike Cleaver and an appearance or two with Jim Goddard. I am very pleased to welcome to the Plante Online program from a double wide in Newton, Brian Frosty Forst. Mr. Forst, good morning.
Well, you've pretty much said it all there. I have nothing to say. Thanks for calling us. See you later.
Have a good day.
The legend thing, I don't think Red Robinson would be pleased to share that title, but nevertheless.
But the guy brought rock and roll to Vancouver, didn't he?
Well, he would tell you that. rock and roll arrived in Vancouver on its own. And whoever was in place at the time would be the one who would be known as the one who brought it to Vancouver, as I see it. Mind you, he did what he did very well for the time that he did it, because that's when I began. I was his replacement. Mm-hmm. As he left CJOR, where he really established himself way back when, and went to WX, and they needed somebody to replace him at CJOR and do the same thing. And that's where I began in Vancouver. And, of course, I couldn't hold a candle to him. He had the market cornered for another year and a half or 2 years. So I ended up pumping gas at a gas station after they figured out that I couldn't do it as well as he did it. But as I say, right place, right time.
And so the 32 years that you spent on the morning...
I never counted them. I didn't realize
no.
that many.
Yeah. I mean, was that, do you think, the best time in sort of radio in this city, at least?
I don't know whether you mean in my career or in radio as the golden era, as it's known, exists. In my career, I would say no. Well, there are so many ups that it's hard to fasten on one. But certainly, I would think the most memorable times were the initial times following that CJOR disaster, when a bunch of us started up C-Fun. Mm-hmm. And eventually knocked off Red and all the other high-paid American guys over WX, because that was just a bunch of young guys, which is what we were, and we had no direction, and management didn't know what the heck we were doing, but they let us have a free hand. And so for 5 years, we just went at it, and there were some very talented people involved there, led by one only semi-adult named Al Jordan. But that was the days of Brian Lord and Jerry Landa and Dave McCormick and a few other similar types, and just a bunch of kids loving what they did, knocking off the high-powered rock and rollers, CKWX, in those days. So that, and working 15 hours a day because you wanted to, and I would say that had to be the most memorable time of, but you're talking about a 32-year morning career on NW. The whole thing there was kind of satisfying. I think the most satisfying of all had to be the discovery of talented people and bringing out the best in them. And by that I mean... the Jennifer Thompsons, the Darren Parkmans, those who, Amy Bell, you know, all kinds of people like that, there's a whole list of them, that people, audiences weren't aware, had something to give. And if I could do anything, it was just to be able to bring out what they had. And when you see their success, to me, that was really satisfying, making kind of characters, or helping them make characters out of themselves. So that's as close as I can pin that down.
So I'm 32 years old, and most of my high school...
I got socks older than that.
Most of my high school years were spent listening to you, and especially in that 7 o'clock hour, because that's when I got up in the morning to go to school, and you know, it kept me awake. You know, I was constantly sleep-deprived, but listening to the radio, I guess, kept me awake. And that hour was always my favorite, because he had people like Joy Metcalf, and then after him, Rick Forchuk, and later on you had Vaughn Palmer as well.
Now, there's a couple of examples.
Yeah.
Vaughn Palmer, of course, could do what he could do without any interruption. He didn't need much back and forth, because he had a lot to say from Capital City, and who knows what he was talking about, only him.
Mm-hmm.
However, the other two you mentioned, Joy and Rick, loved to interact, and the challenge was to say enough to let them shine, and that's what I would enjoy doing. Rick later had, well, I was going to get into a more personal matter with, Rick had trouble later, let's put it that way, but those are two good examples of, and Phil Reimer would be another example.
Mm-hmm.
Of a guy who, if you can figure out just what to say, how to say it, you could make him really shine. Like Phil, you remember that name from when you were listening?
Absolutely, yeah.
Phil was an example. For instance, we had Norm Groman on for the longest time doing weather. Norm could do dialects and accents. I'd wake up early in the morning and I'd write all his stuff out. And then I'd phone him at home, and he would write it all down, and then he'd come back as the character and ad-lib all around the script and have a good time. Now, when Norm decided to retire, we had to figure out what to do. Management in radio or television and media, I guess, are the living example of the Peter Principle. These guys, most management come from sales, and they don't know anything about broadcasting, but once they're in management, they think they do. Let's do it my way kind of a thing. So the secret of the business is to fight off management and all their brilliant suggestions. Like they said, we should fill Norm Groman's spot with somebody who can do dialects and accents. I know somebody. Let's get an actress. Let's get an actor. Somebody, and I'm saying, no, you can't replicate Groman. There is no other Norm Groman out there. He's unique. You got to go in an opposite direction. Of course, management was all against that, but then we had to bring on, I knew of Phil's existence. Phil is not Norm Groman.
Mm-hmm.
He's a totally different guy. Phil plays the big doofus who can't stop laughing, but he knows his stuff. And so it after about a month or so of showing management that this was the direction to go, they had to agree with me, and Phil turned out to be the next weather guy who fit in very differently, but as well as Norm in a different way. And Joy and Rick were similar. They had their own thing to offer, but again, you had to know how to bring it out of them. I don't wish to sound immodest, but the only comparison that I can come up with, everybody thought that Johnny Carson was a genius at what he did. What he did was to let the guest shine. Where a lot of hosts today, like the Conan O'Briens and the Jay Lenos, although Jay had good ratings, they were terrible interviewers, but they knew how to bring out of the guest what they had within them. And that is Joy Metcalf, Rick Forchuk, Phil Reimer, Parkman, all of those guys. That was the challenge of it, to make it a show. Not that you won't hear me. I'd be surprised if I ever use my name.
Right.
You won't hear me say it's the Frosty Force Show. First of all, it wasn't a show in my mind. It was a program. And also, it wasn't me. It was everybody in there. Although I end up taking credit later on. But and I'll I'll take that at my old age. But it's everybody that you bring in there. It wasn't quite the same when we were playing music, which we did for the longest time. Mm-hmm. And then they decided the music was too expensive, and so we better start substituting people instead. I guess that was a whole different philosophy, obviously, but you are probably more familiar with when we had people instead of music, so that's what we're talking about.
I mean, I guess Philip Till suffered with a comparison with you. I mean, people right off the bat said the show wasn't good because they expected, I guess they expected you in the morning and expected him to do you in the morning.
Phil was at a bit of a disadvantage in that he was, when I left there, it was a combination firing and my quitting, because Toronto, which runs everything now, television, radio, and newspapers, I had no idea about the uniqueness of CKNW. They wanted to even cancel the Orphans Fund, which is a great public relations thing which NW does.
Mm-hmm.
But they decided that every radio station they owned, and they own a lot of them in every province, should be exactly the same, I guess because they'd be easier to control or easier to sell on a national scale or who knows, it's Toronto. Everybody should be the same. They should all be news, talk, radio. So the program director, Tom Plasteris, very nice fellow and very smart, had to be the one who said to me at the end, we have been instructed by Toronto that you have to do a news format now. And I just thought, what? You want me to get the crime reporters on and Vaughn Palmer's and be serious and all that? And Tom said, oh, yeah, come on, we know you can be serious. You can do it if you try. And I think he knew, maybe he wanted me to try it. But I thought, no. So I had to quit. And obviously, well, it was time, frankly, because I was an old guy. But also, it was the obvious end of the so-called golden era. I think I'm dancing around your original question, and I got lost there. But what was it you were talking
well,
about?
Well, I mean, people expected your
oh,
show.
Oh, Philip, I'm sorry. So he's the obvious choice. You want somebody who knows all about news because they want the news format, and hopefully with a personality at the same time because it's mornings. Who do you choose? Philip Till, because he was there.
Yeah.
And also, he had to take... Also, they wanted to save money. Toronto wanted to save money, and Philip would work a lot cheaper than I would. So... there he was. So he, as I say, had to suffer from having to do what Toronto wanted, and then he tossed his own little things into the mix. But it was like a substituting Phil Reimer for Norm Groman and putting tape over his mouth. I mean, Philip, it was evident to me that he was brilliant. We used to have him on from London, England, when he worked for NBC.
Mm-hmm.
He and a fellow named Fred Kennedy, who originally was a British Columbia guy, and they used to file sardonic, sarcastic, funny reports on gossip out of England when they weren't doing serious stuff. And they were just a riot. Philip is a heck of a writer, and he can write very funny stuff. But you can't stretch that out to 3.5 hours. And so, again, he maybe got a little bit out of his depth when he got a whole 3 or 3.5 hours that he had to fill. It's hard to do that. So I don't think it would be a fair knock to say, you know, nobody can be anybody. There's a couple of fellows that I know who used to be in the news business, and they're always critiquing talk show hosts, whether it was Bill Good or whoever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear things like, well, why can't they be more like Johnny Carson, or why can't they be like Jack Webster or Rafe Mayer? Well, there aren't any of those guys anymore, and they can't be like them, and you can't find them because there's no training ground for them anymore because of the way the business has gone. The era is over. There won't be another Jack Webster or another Frosty or another Norm Groman. That's not to say we were all so wonderful. It's just that we were, you know, the fortunate ones who had our own quirks in that particular golden era time, and we're very thankful that it was there and that we played a part in it. but you can't replicate these people anymore. You can't replace me with somebody like me. You got to do go in another direction. And then when you go in another direction, you got to give them a budget and a supporting cast. Because it wasn't me there. It was, say, everybody I surrounded myself with, plus everybody on the radio station. The most important part, the backbone of the radio station, which everybody knew, was the newsroom, which doesn't exist anymore. It was huge, with all of its investigative reporters, news cars, airplanes. It was huge. Everybody, if they wanted to know what was, half the news that they put on the air, they didn't just report. They went out and found it and made it, which you don't do anymore. Then we had a publicity department, a promotions department, which had billboards plastering the town, mm-hmm. not just saying CKNW, but they were really clever. One little minor example, they had a billboard at the ferry terminal out in Tawasin that was all done in kind of plaids and ginghams and old-style materials, and it said, "Welcome home, CKNW." Brilliant, mm-hmm. because everybody who got off that ferry coming back into Vancouver would see that, and it gave them a warm feeling. They would do May Day celebrations in New Westminster. They would have marked news cars covering the town. They would have television ads. They let us, the personalities, go out and create our own television ads, which we thought were quite amusing and had great fun doing. There wasn't only news and promotion. One of the philosophies of CKNW was if somebody is better outside the station, for instance, these days, the best disc jockey might be the guy who does beat radio in the morning. I don't know. I just throw that out there. Well, you don't let them beat you. You go and hire them. There's nobody better than the people who are on air at CKNW, because if they are better, NW goes and hires them. So that was another bit of their philosophy. The promotion department, the newsroom, the traffic department. We had brilliant people in our copy department. $1.49 Day Woodward's mm-hmm. was invented, one of 100 things invented and composed in our copy department. And on and on the list goes. So you cannot say, well, if they'd only find one guy to replace, say, John McComb, although he doesn't need replacing, then everything would be wonderful. You know, there's like 200 people that you got to find, recruit, pay, and put in there to make it go back the way it was. It ain't going to happen.
So the sense of humor that you have, the wit, the timing, the persona that Frosty was, where did that come from? Did that come from your folks?
Well, you know, I mean, how does anybody get diabetes? I think it's just something that you're kind of, whether you're, it's in your genes or whether you grow up with it, I suspect it's a combination of both. I know that I had a very funny English mother. And if I have a sense of humor, I suspect it is more like an English than an American sense of humor. And I don't know, when you're also loaded on coffee and 222s, things tend to come out of you real fast as well. And if you're a smart ass and kind of insecure and very infantile, then you blurt out all the things that I would blurt out, because I confess to being guilty to all of those things. So that... there's no answer to that. You know, that's why does anybody have green eyes? I don't know.
Because I guess humor, the way we're humorous is from who we find funny. So the way you were, was that from, say, someone you liked watching growing up or listening to?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I did like people who did similar stuff to what I did, like Don Rickles, mm-hmm. like a guy named Jackie Leonard, who preceded Don Rickles. And I liked people who could do stuff that wasn't written, like Lenny Bruce, and people like that, as opposed to your Bob Hopes and so forth. I didn't care for those guys. I don't know that I would learn from them. I was probably encouraged by them, but you can't learn to be a wise ass or a radio guy. I mean, they can teach you various rudiments of the game at BCIT, but they can't teach you to be a personality. It's either something that some wise program director or a radio station or television manager thinks he can detect in you and puts you on and lets you do your thing. I think the best program director we ever had at CKNW was a fellow named Hal Davis, whose philosophy was, hire the right people and leave them alone. And nobody prior to him or nobody after him has done that. I mean, they all want to stick their finger in there. So Hal was able to know or to see a germ of something in you. I don't just mean me. I mean the Rick Honeys, the Dave McCormicks, those people. He knew when he heard them elsewhere that they had that something, in quotes, and he felt that he could bring it out and make it into something a lot bigger. And that's what he did, and that's where a lot of the personalities came from. The Hal Davis era, who heard people doing their little silly things in smaller venues, and he brought them over to the big show, and away it went.
So something you touched about in the Mike Cleaver interview that I found fascinating, because you mentioned Rick Honey.
Mind you, I was full of beer when I did Mike Cleaver, so I don't know.
Oh, really? Well, you mentioned Rick Honey, and you mentioned Red Robinson, and these guys are extroverts, were extroverts.
Yeah.
You, on the other hand, self-confessed introvert, yet you, did that part of it, I mean, the way you are, the way you were, did that inform the personality that Frosty was?
I don't know. Again, it's one of those green eyes things. Just as you were saying that, it was whipping around in my mind. I was just thinking that there's nothing wrong with being an extrovert and an introvert. I really envied those guys. They were able to get up on stage and shine. I always thought that Red and Rick were good examples of people, Rick in particular, who I really envied. I was very jealous of. Because they could go out and they could just hypnotize thousands of people standing in front of them or in an audience. And I thought, wow, would I like to do that? I couldn't do that. If I'm in front of two people, I'd just freeze up and go and hide behind a curtain somewhere. But I didn't feel that they would do as well. I mean, obviously they did wonderfully well on the radio, but not as well as they did off the radio. That's not to insult what they did, it's to compliment what they did off radio. Because when you're on radio, in my opinion, those who were more successful were those who would picture and then communicate with one person. My person changed maybe three or four times over my lifetime. Originally, I was talking to my mother. And then when I started to become a little more irreverent, I kind of shut mother out. I didn't want to hear that. And I would talk to a person driving along Marine Drive to UBC, going to school. And you don't, for an example, if you watch some of the people on television now doing weather, or an occasion one of the anchors refer to the audience as everybody,
mm-hmm.
I think that's wrong, because then they're talking to everybody where they should be talking to you. And that's kind of what I did. Red and Rick, and not just them, but they're extroverted other people who did the same thing, might very often say everybody, or Rick would say, hello, British Columbia, you know, and it was a good gag you stole from Hello, Vietnam, or Good Morning, Vietnam. But again, you're not talking to one person, uh-huh. Which is what I was doing. And I think that's one of the things, and it's not something I consciously set out to do. I think it's an introverted thing, to go back to your original question. I don't feel like I'm talking to a mass crowd, because it would freeze me up. I'm just in a darkened room. I have windows blocked off, so nobody's staring in the door. Nobody can come into the room, whether they have business in there or not, when I was on the air. Because I'm talking to that one person, and I don't want to be distracted. And when you're relaxed like that, then you can come out with these little rapier wit, saber-tongue things, you know, because you're only talking to one person, just like you. If you're sitting having a beer in a pub with one of your friends, you'll say all kinds of stuff. But if you're sitting in front of 15 people at a wedding reception, you won't do that. So that's kind of an answer, I guess, to what you're asking.
So in preparing for this, I went to the clippings files and found some articles from say, 25, 30 years ago. It was news then. It's probably gossip, but I mean, you know, at the end of the day, it's history. You can carry, you know, if you want to answer them, you go ahead, but I'll ask the questions anyway.
I'll bet you $100 I could answer every one of them.
So there was an article a Denny Boyd column from 1987.
Boyd, of course, was a columnist. Mm-hmm. He was not really a gossipy guy. Well, he was, I guess, but on a higher level than Wasserman.
Mm-hmm. And so he wrote in the Sun in 1987 that you were making $1 million. Was that yearly or was that for the duration of the contract?
I have a faint memory of his saying that. I don't recall the reaction with the bosses. No doubt we exchanged a few laughs over it. What year was it again?
87.
Well... At my highest earning period, I was making not quite half that.
Mm.
And it wasn't 87. 87 was before that. So I can't imagine what I was making in 87. Maybe a quarter of that, I guess. I'm guessing. But I don't know where that million... The only person who might have made $1 million, and I doubt it, I seriously doubt it, but the strongest rumor out there was Fred Latrimo. And the reason I doubt it, and he was because he was very valuable to his little audience at that time, who would just, I don't say little bemeaningly,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a very faithful, wealthy, they thought, audience, therefore it would justify paying Fred a lot of money. But it wasn't ever number one rated, so they couldn't charge a lot of money, but on FM there's virtually no staff that he had to share the money with. So I thought, well, it's possible that Fred might be doing $1 million. He should be, because they can afford it. He only had a supporting staff of maybe 5 or 6 people, where NW is paying 200 people. I mean, all the money has to go somewhere, so maybe Fred was closer to $1 million, but I certainly wasn't.
The other thing from articles, I guess they went from the late 80s to the 90s, was I guess Al Davidson had sued CKNW for wrongful dismissal.
Yep.
And your name had come up in a number of the articles.
Yep.
What part did you play in all of that?
You wouldn't have access, I guess, and I don't know exactly what the clippings are. One of the, when the province first went tabloid, that is these little tiny papers that they mm-hmm. put out now, and they were a lot more tabloid then than they are now. I forget whether it was their first ever edition or very close to it. There was a picture. Oh, no, it was not a picture. It was a headline. The headline was a huge headline on the front page of the Vancouver Province. Frosty calls Davidson a fool.
No, I've got it right here. It's a Mark Edge. The 13th of March, 1990, Big Al a fool, says Frosty.
That was, well, I wondered about the exact wording. What is it again?
Big Al a fool, says Frosty, filed nasty memos on Davidson.
That cut me so bad. And not just me, here I am being selfish. It hurt Al.
Mm-hmm.
It hurt his family. It really hurt his family. Because, as you can imagine, Al and I were friends. Al would do so much for me. He'd fly me up to his little place. He had my back for everything. He was wonderful, wonderful man, and a great broadcaster. And that came out. It came out of a note of frustration to management. Al, as I'm sure he will admit now, if you communicate with him in heaven, would say to me that he had a brain problem. He had some kind of a tumor behind the eye, and it was pressing against his brain. I think that's how it worked. He tried to describe it to me all the time without much success, and it was affecting what he would say. And for the longest time, I would be sitting right across the desk from him. He wouldn't do his sport from another studio. He'd sit right there with me, and I'd be looking right in his face while he was doing his sports. And I was thinking to myself, am I going crazy or is it Al? Because I'm not understanding what he's saying. It wasn't making sense. The words were all discombobulated and the sentences were ending in the wrong place and he'd start other ones. I mean, it just wasn't something was really off, and it was getting worse and worse, and not only from the pressure that he had behind his eye, but he was taking meds to control the pain. And I felt so badly, and I kept on sending little notes off to management saying, are you guys listening to Al? Because something's off here. And I would get no response from management, and it was becoming very frustrating. And I don't know what I wanted it to do. Their management, it's up to them, but they had to intervene in my mind. And finally, out of frustration, and after about 20 notes, and at least a year, and it was just getting worse and worse, because other people were talking to me about it, I finally sent a note into management to try to get their attention, to saying, Al sounds like a fool. Here I am talking to this one guy in management that I know tried to make my point. So when they let, and obviously they were listening to me, much to, I didn't know. And finally, they called him in and they let him go because obviously they agreed. Then Al filed for wrongful dismissal. Then the lawyers got involved in the act. And part of the deal now with what you know as paper trails, if you want to fire anybody at any job for any reason, you have to have a paper trail. And the lawyers requisitioned, or whatever the expression is, all of the memos relating to Al Davidson over the years, which management had kept. And I didn't know anything about that. I do now, too late. But all of these notes that I was giving to management, they were keeping. I guess to establish a paper trail with my unfortunate words on them. I didn't mean Al is a fool. I meant Al, some of the things he said sounded to me foolish. So this is the kind of stuff that the lawyers released to the press. And this is how it ended up in the newspaper. And the very next day, when that newspaper came out, the very next day at 5 o'clock in the morning, these are some of the indelible memories of the business. My private line rang just as I sat down at 5 o'clock in the morning before I went on the air. The unmistakable voice of Al Davidson. I said, hello. And he said, Frosty, I'd go to the wall for you. Click. I knew it was Al phoning, and I knew how hurt he was by that headline, because he'd got it at home, obviously. And then later, and that was, I couldn't get back to him. He wouldn't take calls from me. I couldn't talk to him. He finally died one day. I went to his funeral, and there was his wife and daughter, and I approached them to apologize in the lobby of this church, and I just shooed everybody else away, and I went up to them because I knew them, and I wanted to tell them how badly I felt about that and tried to explain how it went down, and they very patiently listened to me, and I don't recall exactly what I said to them. I tried my best to explain what I'm saying to you, and they didn't, the word escapes me, they didn't necessarily accept my apology, although they seemed to be a little more at peace having my explain it to them, which was a good thing. But that's as far as I was able to try and backtrack that whole thing. That's how that went down. And that was most unfortunate. But, you know, it's business, and whether Al has, Al would say now, he understands, whether you have the guy's back or whether you're the best of friends. That's what's wrong with making friends in the business. Sometimes, for the sake of the program, decisions have to be made.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how good a friend you are. I would expect it would happen to me, and it kind of did, frankly. But anyway, that's the story on that one.
So I always thought that if you did a Mount Rushmore of open line radio in British Columbia, you'd put Burns and then Webster, obviously. And then the other two guys you put, I put Gary Bannerman and Rafe Mayer. Did you work with all four of them?
Not with Burns.
No.
But the others, yeah. It's funny you said Bannerman. I would have said Bannerman, but that's strictly because I really liked them. Well, I really liked the talk show hosts, I guess, is kind of like the it's like the introvert-extrovert thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're all extrovert. Well, yeah, I guess even Bannerman was. But they're very different characters. some are extreme. They're all self-involved. You have to be, and there's nothing wrong with that. But some are so self-involved that it's just really annoying. However, Webster and Bannerman were not. They were down to earth. For instance, my wife is a little gal that I met at performing at a cultural center in northern Thailand. She's a Lao. Mm-hmm. And when she first came over here, she looked like she was 15 years old. She wasn't much older, but that's what she looked like. And she had the little communist pajamas on and all that stuff. And she was afraid when I left in the morning after we married, shortly after she came over, I'd bring her in with me because she was afraid to stay on a farm where we lived. And she'd sit down in a corner, little 90-pound, 5-foot-tall, 15-year-old girl in these little black communist pajamas sitting in the corner. Webster and Davidson would just kick anybody out of there. They'd kick out the premier, Jack Monroe, all these people. If they saw my wife, whose name is Darapon, and they come over to her and they put their arm around her, and they'd say, if there's anything we can do for you, if people are bothering you, if Frosty's not good to you, any of this stuff, they would, until she was finished talking to them, and then they'd leave. They'd do that every time they saw her. That's the kind of guys they were. If Bannerman wasn't situated downtown, I suspect he would do the same thing. Mind you, Webster wasn't in the studio either, but we'd see him when I went over to BCTV with Darapon following behind me. And Webster would be holding court in the cafeteria with all these important people. And he'd just tell them all, I'll be back, don't go away. And he'd go over and he'd drag Darapon over to a corner and he'd talk to her for 15 or 20 minutes, or try, because her English was not very good, and they knew that. But that's the kind of people, they were human beings, you know. I mean, they had feelings. They were humble beginnings guys, Al and Jack. And I can't say that. The others that you mentioned are decent characters, but those two really stand out, and they're just different in that respect. So I would certainly put them one and two on the Rushmore. You didn't have, well, Davidson, you didn't have him as a talk show host, but Bannerman, as I say, I had a lot of affection for him. A lot of people don't, but I did.
Yeah. He was very lovely to me. I mean, when I started
really?
This, yeah. Like, I found him online, and I thought, well, he'd be a good guest to talk to. So I had him on a couple of times, and even before he came on, he would send me these notes about the work that I was doing. And that meant a great deal, you know, for someone who's doing this as a hobby.
I'm Gary Bannerman, and you're not.
Yeah.
I remember him. We used to use that all the time. There was another guy, Terry Moore. You might remember his name.
Right.
Enough about me, Frosty. Let's talk about you. What do you think about me? These guys were rather comically self-involved. It might have been an act. I don't mean that to be demeaning, but Gary and Terry kind of would mention their own names a lot, and but I think it was just because they had nothing else to say at that moment, you know.
Yeah.
It's nice to hear about Gary. It just rather confirms what I suspected was true and not just me.
Yeah. One of my favorite moments on your show years ago, you had Joy Metcalf on, and she was talking about...
What a sweetheart, Joy.
Isn't she? I won a contest with her once, and I went to dinner with her, and that was one of my more memorable moments.
And may I ask where you went?
We went to the Metropolitan Hotel, the Diva restaurant there.
Oh, yeah. Joy, of course, is still among us,
happy
to say.
No, she's great, yeah. Anyway, so she was talking about some event that she'd attended at a Chinese restaurant. And you told her the next time she was at a Chinese restaurant, she should go up to the host and try to get a table, of course, and say that she was Lup Sup Guai Lo. Now, I didn't know what that was. And so I went to school, and the first person that I knew spoke Chinese, I asked them what that was.
I must say at this point that when I was going over to meet Darapon originally in Thailand, we stopped in Hong Kong, a bunch of us Prince people, and we were having a tour in a tour bus, and it's obviously a Chinese guy was the tour guide, a very funny, I still remember his name, it was Tony, of all things, But he started laughing at one point as we're going up and down the streets of Hong Kong, and we asked him why he was laughing. And he said, because of what these people were pointing and yelling at you guys. And I said, what was that? He said, Lapsap Gwailo. And I said, what's Lapsap Gwailo? He said, well, Gwailo is kind of a demeaning word for white guys or foreigners, mm-hmm. and Lapsap is garbage. And he thought that was very funny, and so did we. Maybe they were laughing when they yelled it at us, but I wanted to let Joy... that's why I thought if she were to tell the Chinese waiter, who would hopefully speak Cantonese or Mandarin, she is Lapsap Gwailo, not knowing...
Yeah.
I don't know whether she did it or not. Maybe you do.
Well, no, but I mean, I don't think she got it, and I'm doubtful that most of your audience got it, but I mean, that's just genius to do that on the radio.
Well, not genius. It might be to a couple of Chinese people, but nobody else knew what we were talking about, so it's just nonsense.
But, I mean, you know, it took me a couple hours to figure it out, and, I mean, the laugh
How
afterwards...
How did you figure it out if you didn't know?
Well, I found someone at school who spoke Chinese,
oh.
And then, you know, a couple hours later, and then they're telling me, and I thought
and
that was...
And do I have the translation correct, according to your translator?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
It is garbage foreigner.
Yeah, you know, white garbage was what...
White devil.
Yeah, something
we're
like that.
We're all known as white devils, and we are.
Are you enjoying retirement?
Oh, boy, you know, the most common question is, do you miss radio?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people who were in radio would be asked the same question as would those who were in television or who were in newspaper or who were selling shoes. And all I can say is you kind of miss the good times, but then don't you even if you're sailing a boat? It's better to be able to say it was that golden era where I was there from the very... from practically the beginning, not quite, but for part of the beginning. And although I overstayed my welcome, I was there at the end of it. It's gone, so there's nothing to miss. Because it's not there anymore, because you can't hire 200 geniuses and go back to work with them like NW had. I think the best comparison would be, I used to own a beautiful log house on Pender Island for about 5 or 6 years, and I could miss that. But then I would say to anybody who would ask the question that you did, how would you like to own a home on Pender Island with a view of the killer whales and the fairies and Ganges, logs, a fireplace, blah, 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 for 5 years, or never own it at all? What would you say? Well, I'll take the 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, you can't make it go on forever. And the radio thing, I was so happy to have been there when it was going on. And so lucky. But it's not going on anymore the way it was then. Mind you, the people who were involved in it today would look back at it maybe, I guess, one day and say, boy, those were the days. That is what they're doing today. But I think that era of just the way it was when kids were allowed to grow up in Vancouver and break into radio. I mean, now there's nothing to break into because all the small markets where you get your start are carrying, arms of NW and the CBC and so forth. So there's really nowhere to break in anymore. So a long, convoluted answer to your question. I'm enjoying the retirement, I guess you could say. Had I not purchased a motorcycle or a motor scooter just before I quit radio, and it's now morphed into a motorcycle. That's what I do every day. I motorcycle everywhere.
Hmm.
And if I wasn't doing that, I don't know what I'd do. I don't care for gardening. And after a while, it's funny, no matter what kind of a job you're doing, you think, oh boy, one day I'm going to retire. I'm saving just enough money so I can travel around the world. And then you find that, oh yeah, but when you retire, you're like 65. And maybe your legs or your back or your feet don't work anymore, so you don't want to travel around the world. But that's why I say if it wasn't for the motorcycle, I'd be going crazy. So, you know, you just sit around here reading the obituaries when you get a little bit older and watching a lot of TV and talking to Joseph Planta, and that's about what retirement is about. It's not as exciting as it was, of course, when you're in biz, no matter what your business was. But I'm not unenjoying it, let me put it that way.
Do you think radio can still be relevant?
No.
Really?
No. How can it? How? No. No. I don't. Well, you know, I'm not into computers because I'm not a young guy. I email, and that's about it. And people will say, the consensus appears to be, that young people are all getting their news and information from their iPhones or from their computers, and therefore things are evolving and morphing. How can it be as relevant as it once was? And when it once was 6 a.m. radio stations and 3 or 4 newspapers and maybe 2 or 3 television stations, of course, and no computers, that's when things were relevant. But then times are a-changing, and so many people who are of my era aren't getting that, and it ain't what it used to be, and that's fine. Things move on, and everybody's having a good time, and everybody's informed. Matter of fact, maybe they're too informed with the way opinions are splitting off into Fox and MSNBC, whether it's Canada or the USA. We're all, you know, getting a little too much information. But the fun of radio and TV appears to be kind of gone, unless it's big-time stuff out of Hollywood or out of New York City, I think.
Yeah. Brian, you're such a prince to do this. I really appreciate it, and it's a great chance for me to tell you how much I loved the show growing up. So
I've always said that's better than money, you know?
Well,
somebody will recognize a signature when you go into the bank and sign a credit card and that kind of stuff, and, oh, weren't you so-and-so? Or having somebody such as yourself say those words. That's the payoff, I'll tell you that.
But you would never tell management that.
Oh, hell no. Well, as a matter of fact, I did tell management on many occasions, you know what, if you'd say something nice once in a while, I wouldn't take so much money from you.
Yeah.
And that's just our way of extorting some compliments out of management, getting as much money as we could. It's just a reaffirmation of what you're doing, and that is the God's honest truth.
Yeah, I heard Betty Davis say that once, that if the studio heads were nicer, they wouldn't have asked for much money.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. The great Brian Force joined me on the line from White Rock in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.